We often hear how omega-3 fatty acids are good for a healthy heart, a sharper brain, and a longer life. But do omega-3s really bring us all these benefits? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest in the first part of the program is Paul Greenberg, award-winning author of The Omega Principle. In it, Greenberg explores the history, science, and business behind omega-3 fatty acids. Then we'll talk about aquaculture in Iowa with Mark Bratz of Iowa Shrimp Farms in Sigourney and Joseph Morris of the North Central Regional Aquaculture Center at ISU. That's all coming up. First, this news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, for years we've heard about the health benefits of omega-3 fatty acids, how they're a key to a healthy heart, to a sharper brain, even a longer life. And those claims have landed omega-3s at the top of the list of best-selling non-prescription drugs for the last two decades. Some estimates put the sales of omega-3 supplements at more than $15 billion annually. However, recent medical studies have challenged their effectiveness. My guest is Paul Greenberg. He's the author of The Omega Principle, Seafood and the Quest for a Long Life and a Healthier Planet. In it, Greenberg explores the history, science, and business behind omega-3 fatty acids. Greenberg is the James Beard Award-winning bestseller of Four Fish and American Catch. He's a regular contributor to the New York Times, also a Pew Fellow in Marine Conservation. Paul Greenberg, welcome to our program.
Hey, thanks, Ben. Thanks for having me.
So tell us, what prompted you to investigate omega-3s? Why did you write this book?
Well, so I'm a lifelong fisherman. Seafood in the ocean have always been a huge part of my life. But when I started to hit my mid-40s, I noticed that whenever I would do a public event around my book, people would come up to me and they'd say, well, what about the omega-3s? Does this have omega-3s? What does that do? And it was right around the time that I was starting to experience all of those midlife things. So, you know, I was 47 at the time, started having knee issues, higher blood pressure, foggy thinking. And, you know, there were oftentimes I would find myself up in the middle of the night, like so many of us do. And unfortunately, there was the internet, and I started Googling around for, you know, homeopathic remedies for all these issues. And every time I did that, what would come up? But omega-3 fatty acids. It was sort of like every single problem you could imagine. And then, you know, it's sort of fun for maybe listeners out there, if you type into your Google search engine, if you type omega-3s may, you get this funny, crazy combination of things, like omega-3s may increase brain volume, might build muscle mass in older adults, and my favorite, might boost sperm competitiveness. I'm not sure why I would want my sperm to be more competitive, but accordingly, omega-3s might do that. So anyway, so I started to look into it, and at the same time, because I've always been sort of working and looking at environmental health, I wanted to look at sort of how omega-3s worked in the marine environment and how an omega-3-based way of eating might change our relationship both to the oceans and to the land that we farm and that we use for producing food.
Mm-hmm. I want to get to that land question because you're talking to listeners who are in a landlocked state after all.
Yeah.
But let's first of all lay the foundation and tell us, what are they? What are omega-3s?
So our omega-3s are what are called polyunsaturated fatty acids, and that's as scientific, that's as chemical basis as I'm going to get. I should say I did get a C in chemistry, so, you know, I tried to bring my chemistry to a C+ for the benefit of listeners. But basically, they're highly flexible fats. They don't stay solid at room temperature. They're fluid. And when we incorporate them into our cell membranes, they do all sorts of interesting things. They're actually 10% of the human brain by weight. The human brain is actually just a piece of fat on a stick. It's mostly fat, the brain. And 10% of that mass are omega-3 fatty acids. They seem to be involved in the transfer of energy across cell membranes and information across cell membranes, so they are very much involved with the brain. And then on the heart side of things, they are involved in chemical reactions that seem to reduce inflammation and lead us toward resolution. So that's what they do in the body. What they do in the world and in the environment is also interesting because they actually were invented by plankton millions, hundreds of millions of years ago, specifically to adapt to a cooling planet. As photosynthesis pulled all the carbon out of the atmosphere and things started getting cooler and cooler, plankton needed to adapt to a cooler environment. So they created the omega-3 fatty acids that made their cell membranes more flexible at colder temperatures. So that's basically how they came to being.
Mm-hmm. And so when we connect them with fish, it's actually not the fish that produce these omega-3 fatty acids, it's plankton?
No, that's what's interesting. It is actually plankton that make omega-3 fatty acids. And fish just bioaccumulate them. They concentrate them, just like they actually concentrate things like PCBs and mercury from the outside environment. Interestingly enough, all the phytoplankton that made all of those omega-3s over, you know, that have been making them for hundreds of millions of years, they're also responsible for this other key lipid, this other key fat in our environment, which is petroleum. All of those microscopic phytoplankton sank to the bottom hundreds of millions of years ago, were compressed and pressurized and transformed into oil. So, these key, that's another thing I wanted to look at in the book was the very important role that plankton play in the world. They actually produce half of the world's breathable oxygen, and a huge amount of the carbon in the world passes through their membranes at one point or another.
Mm-hmm. I want to have you comment on your research on the health benefits that we've been hearing about and whether those hold up under scrutiny. But first of all, this is really interesting in the first part of your book, how you talk about human evolution and the possible role that omega-3 fatty acids, this molecule, played in the development of human evolution. And you mention also something called the aquatic ape hypothesis. Go into that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. Well, again, these are all hypotheses because, frankly, I wasn't there 300,000 years ago when this stuff happened. But humans, there's an interesting correlation between human seafood consumption and the arrival of higher thought and higher levels of activity of humans. So the aquatic ape hypothesis puts forward the idea that once early hominids, started wading out into the water to go after shellfish, that in these zero-gravity environments where they were more able to kind of float, that it might have prompted early hominids to start standing upright. So that might have been the first step for us to move from basically apes to hominids. Again, very highly controversial. I wasn't there. But the other interesting thing that happens in early human evolution is, for the first 270,000 years of Homo sapiens' existence on this planet, we don't have much to show for it. There's not much in the way of civilization that you can find in the archaeological record. But around 10 to 30,000 years ago, you start to find giant piles of shells around human habitations. It seems that humans, once we overexploited land animals, we turned to seafood. And once we started eating all of that seafood, fairly soon afterwards, you start to see things like agriculture. You start to see the beginnings of modern languages. So there is this idea out there that what if we had this influx of omega-3s into our brains from all the seafood we were consuming, and what if that put us over the top and moved us from a sort of hunter-gatherer kind of people to a more civilized farmer-type societies with all sorts of other more complicated things in their societies.
Mm-hmm. As you said, that's one hypothesis. We don't know whether it's causal or just coincidental, right?
That's right. And in fact, the whole question of correlation versus causation is kind of a theme throughout the book, because not only is it a question in this, did omega-3s help us become more intelligent? It's also a question as to whether omega-3s work at all in supplement form. And this kind of comes up later in the book where I look at, I think a lot of the listeners out there have probably been taking omega-3 dietary supplements for some time with the idea that heart health is strongly influenced by omega-3s. But what's interesting in the last few years is that there have been these big studies, these big randomized control trials, that seem to not show causation. That, in other words, taking an omega-3 supplement may not improve heart health.
Well, let's go into that. I'll remind our listeners, Paul Greenberg is my guest. His latest book, the Omega Principle, Seafood and the Quest for a Long Life, a Healthier Planet. It's a book in which he explores the history, the science, and the business behind omega-3 fatty acids. This is a huge business. Some put it estimates at $15 billion annually. It's one of the best-selling non-prescription drugs and has been for many years. Let's dig down, Paul, at this point and talk a little bit about the claims that are made. We have this anti-inflammation claim, the role that it has in preventing heart disease and strokes. What did you find there?
You know, the very first studies around omega-3s and heart health happened when two doctors, Hans Bang and Jorn Dyerberg, went to Greenland, and they had read in an article that Inuit people in Greenland had very low levels of cardiovascular disease. And when they went there, they took blood samples and they spun them down, and they found that those people who had a diet that primarily consisted of whales and seals had very high levels of omega-3 fatty acids. And so they produced what's, you know, a hypothesis, not a theory, not a proven thing, but a hypothesis, which is that, you know, if you have a high diet high in omega-3 fatty acids, that might be the help cause you to have lower risk of cardiovascular disease. And so that hypothesis sort of carried forward for some time. There have been better studies done since then. Initially, there were what are called randomized control trials where, you know, I give you a supplement and I give somebody else a placebo, and we chart you over time to see how that heart health works out. In the early randomized control trials, they did show very, very strong effect of omega-3 fatty acids. But recently, in the last 5 to 10 years, there have been many studies that have shown no effect at all. And so that's something that we, you know, really need to look into. One reason might be is that we've developed all these other ways of treating heart disease. We have stents, we have statins, and all these other anti-inflammatory things. And it could be that the omega-3 effect is being sort of masked and muted by that. But, you know, there's more and more studies that seem to point in the direction that heart health is not necessarily addressed with a supplement. And that's why, I guess, in the book, I try to steer people more in the direction of trying to change their diet rather than trying to supplement themselves out, you know, into a more omega-3 rich world.
Mm-hmm. Speak a little bit to the energy transfer claims of omega-3 fatty acids, that we can transfer, that our nerve cells communicate better, possibly?
Yeah, basically, the omega-3s are part of cell signaling mechanisms in nerve cells. And I do believe that that's true. And, you know, it's been pretty much documented and proven that omega-3s are integral to the human brain and to human neurosystems. One question, though, is how did those omega-3s get into the body in the first place? And that's, again, debatable. One of the main ways we get omega-3s into our brains in the first place is actually through breastfeeding. Human females can actually upgrade short-chain omega-3 fatty acids into long-chain through the process of lactation or through the process of forming breast milk. And that goes into infant brains, helps them form over time, which is why I actually am a very strong believer in breastfeeding. The recent claims that, you know, from this administration against breastfeeding, I think, are ridiculous, and I take great issue with that. The people in the omega-3 world would argue that breastfeeding is not enough, that we need to be supplementing that with additional things like supplements. That might be true, but it's also a larger question of diet, because it turns out there's this whole other range of compounds called omega-6s that come from land food proteins that may be interfering with our ability to incorporate omega-3s into our bodies.
Mm-hmm. And omega-6s are not good for whatever reason.
Well, so omega-6s also are essential, but there's a whole question of balance, and this is where it comes back to the listeners in Iowa. So, you know, 100 years ago in Iowa and throughout our agricultural regions, we did not have this land food system where we were growing huge amounts of corn and soy and feeding land food animals those grains and those beans.
Mm-hmm.
That switch over to grain and soy feeding of animals changed the fatty acid profile of the meat that we're eating so that it leans more heavily in the direction of omega-6 rather than omega-3s. Why is this important? Well, there is a fair amount of research that shows that omega-6s and omega-3s compete for spaces on the same enzymes. And if there is an overabundance of omega-6s, we cannot convert short-chain omega-3s into the long chains that we need in our brains and also for our hearts. So there's that question. Again, like every piece of research I found in this book, there are people who say, no, that's not happening or that's not that significant. But what I did think was instructive was that even if you don't believe about this omega-3 versus omega-6 competition in the human body, there is this larger question of land food competing against seafood. Mm-hmm. So, you know, right now, we as Americans consume 210 pounds of land food meat per year and only 15 pounds of seafood. And it really shows in the way that we treat our environment. So, you know, all of the nitrate fertilizers that we put on top of corn and soy to make them grow, a lot of that washes into our waterways and is actually causing oxygen-poor dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico and elsewhere, and it's actually decreasing our seafood supply. So you see what I'm saying? There's this sort of omega-3 world of seafood and leafy greens and things like that, and there's this omega-6 world of corn and soy and feedlot animals. And I guess my argument would be to try and rebalance the system so that we have more of an omega-3 world.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the industry, this omega-3 industry that has grown up and in providing these supplements. You actually went on board a ship that harvests fish for omega-3s. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so Peru is the site of the largest single-species fishery in the entire world. In some years, Peru can make up to 10% of all fish caught in the world. So I went out in Peru out of the city of Chimbote, and you just have millions and millions of pounds of fish caught every single year. And that's actually the law, Peruvian law, that over 95% of the fish caught have to be turned over to the reduction industry for making animal feed, fertilizer, and yes, dietary supplements.
Okay, so the reduction industry. So that is, you're just catching huge amounts of fish, and then they're just broken into the components, their oils, their fish meal?
Yep. I mean, you know, it's important to remember that anywhere from 20 to 25 million tons a year are reduced. I mean, that's a quarter of all the fish humans catch are put into these reduction facilities, turned into fish meal, turned into fish oil. And actually, very early on in American agriculture, fish meal was used as a supplement for growing hogs. I mean, I know there in Iowa you grow a fair amount of hogs. Early on in the sort of, as we moved to industrial forms of hog production, people found that fish oil and fish meal was a productive supplement for growing pigs. Now most of that fish meal and fish oil actually goes to aquaculture, the growing of fish and shellfish around the country, or around the world. So that's where it's going now, and also it's going into dietary supplements.
Mm-hmm. You also, in immersing yourself in the world of these dietary supplements, you attended, is it called the GOED Exchange? This is the annual summit of these omega-3s. What is that?
Yeah, so the global organization for EPA and DHA omega-3 fatty acids is this, you know, big organization that includes fish meal and fish oil producers, but also growers of algae and all these other alternative ways of getting omega-3s into our systems. And so I went to, believe it or not, the Ritz-Carlton in the Canary Islands for their annual summit. And, you know, collectively I kind of refer to that whole association of doctors and nutritionists and feed producers, I call that Omega World, because they have this very, you know, omega-focused way of thinking about the universe, and that, you know, omega-3s can cure everything from joints to brain to heart. But I also found when I went to that conference, there was another thing going on. There was a really interesting presentation done by somebody that had analyzed the sort of user preferences of omega-3 users, or rather their what they were hoping for from omega-3s. And what they found was that most people who took omega-3s had a very almost mystical idea of what they thought omega-3s did. And they imagined, you know, they had these surveyors did this user survey, and they found that when they drew a sort of arc of life, that most users of omega-3s tended to be in their 40s and 50s, and they saw this sort of gradual decline, and they saw, you know, all the other people that they knew who were in poor health, and what they wanted to do was to extend what they called the Indian summer of life. That is, instead of having this, like, horrible last 30 years of your life, well, what if we could create this sort of elevated plateau of a slow decline so that we'd get to 85, 90, and then suddenly drop dead suddenly. Like, that's the goal of these people who are very wishful thinkers about omega-3s. But then you look at what omega-3s actually do. Well, they may reduce the risk of certain disease, but this idea of creating a whole Indian summer of life, I think, is something of a fiction.
Mm-hmm. When you went to that annual summit, how much of the discussion is really based on hard, verifiable, good science?
Well, you know, there is a lot of scientific discussion, but it's important to remember that, you know, science, when we're talking about the science, where is the science coming from? Some of those studies are backed by the fish oil and fish meal industry, you know, that they're actually paid for by those industries. There are some objective studies out there. There's actually a really big study that's going to come out in November called the Vital Study, and I would advise listeners to kind of pay attention to what happens, because that study, being done by the Brigham and Women's Hospital, huge amount of subjects, tens of thousands of subjects giving fish oil over many years. And when that study comes out in November, I think we'll be closer to a definitive answer as to whether these things, this in supplement form anyway, whether they truly work. Unfortunately, I had to publish my book, so I couldn't wait until the study came out.
Okay. Talk about the bigger picture, land-based food, sea-based food, when you describe how so much of the seafood is harvested. Talk about the sustainability in our oceans and of the seafood and its connection to land.
Yeah. Well, so as I said, 210 pounds of land food meat are eaten every year by Americans and only 15 pounds of seafood. I do think we could increase that amount, and I think probably the way we're going to have to do it is through ocean farming, or aquaculture, as it's called. If we were, you know, the general estimates are, if we were to rebuild all the wild fish populations out there to sustainable levels, that we could probably up our harvest from, say, 80 million metric tons globally to maybe 110 at most. But really, you know, right now our demand on seafood is actually double that. So we're going to have to do aquaculture. But the question is, which kind of aquaculture, and how are we going to approach that? A big thing that I advocate for is the farming of things like clams, mussels, and oysters. Why? Well, first of all, you don't have to feed them anything. Clams, mussels, and oysters all get rich and plump and omega-3 rich from filtering those same phytoplankton that we know are the creators of omega-3s, but filtering those from the water. They also, in the process, create great structure for juvenile fish to live in. So, and right now, America as a nation is really behind the eight ball when it comes to aquaculture. We're currently ranked 17th in the world, just behind North Korea, in total seafood produced through farming. So, you know, all those kinds of things would be great to incorporate into our diets. The other thing that I looked quite a bit at was the whole question of, you know, so of course not everybody wants to eat clams, mussels, and oysters. There are a lot of people who just want to keep eating their farmed salmon. And that's possibly something we can do in a sustainable way. One of the interesting things that I found out about during the course of this research was that for every forkful of food Americans eat, we throw out about a forkful. So half of all the food that we bring to the table, we throw out. Turns out that there is an amazing creature out there called the black soldier fly, which we can actually put onto food waste, turn that into these little grubs that then can be then used as animal feed in a way that's 98% as efficient as harvesting wild fish like Peruvian anchoveta. So I guess, you know, the message there is, instead of having this aquaculture food system that involves us, you know, in the over-harvest of these little fish, we could actually close the loop and make our waste disposal system into a closed loop for getting more food and more healthy food on our plates.
More of my conversation with Paul Greenberg. The Omega Principle is his book. When we come back, three reasons why Americans don't eat more seafood. The answers may surprise you. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In just a moment, a couple of guests to talk about aquaculture here in Iowa. Mark Bratz of the Iowa Shrimp Farms in Sigourney, and Joe Morris of the North, he's of ISU, of the North Central Regional Aquaculture Center, talk about seafood raised here in Iowa. But first, let's get back to my recent conversation with Paul Greenberg, author of The Omega Principle. In it, he explores the history, science, and business behind omega-3 fatty acids. Well, in the few minutes we have remaining, I wanted to have you address this, and near the back of your book, I was surprised to read, in survey after survey, Americans give three reasons why they don't eat more fish. And I actually quizzed my family. It was kind of tough to get number one, two, and three here. Tell us, why don't, according to surveys, people eat more fish? It's a bit comical.
Yes, it is. It is indeed. And it's so funny when I go to seafood conferences, you know, people in marketing like break their head against these three things. But it's basically, I don't want to touch it, I don't know how to cook it, and I don't want it smelling up my house. So those are the three things. And you wouldn't believe the resorts to which some industries have gone. I remember going to some conference where this fish industry company had come up with this packet of fish that you put in some sort of, like, it's a microwave packet, and you put it in the microwave, and it puffs up, and the no smell emits itself until you kind of rush it to the table and snip it open and dump it on the plate.
Right.
But I think, you know, implicit, I don't know what your family found or what you found when you quizzed your family. I think another major reason that maybe isn't listed there is the price of seafood.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, and it's kind of linked to the one of I don't know how to cook it, because I think people are really deeply afraid of ruining fish. You know, they've spent over $10 a pound oftentimes, and shoot, you know, then they're going to spend all that money, and then they're going to cook it, and it's going to not be very good.
Right.
So that's one of the reasons, actually, I put a few recipes at the back, just because, you know, I actually put myself on an all-fish diet for a year, and so I wanted to kind of give people a sense of,
What was that like?
How you might do that.
after that year of all fish diet, were you like, I can't eat another fish?
You know, to tell you the truth, no. I actually, it kind of put me over the bar in terms of I like fish much more than I used to. Mostly because once I decided, you know, and I should say I did this as part of not just research for the Omega Principle, but also for a PBS Frontline special I did called The Fish on My Plate. And, you know, so I had this, you know, strict rules that I couldn't eat land food meat. I was just going to eat seafood. And what it did is it made me look at the seafood counter in a much more holistic way. I looked at it instead of seeing, you know, usually most Americans, right, they have their chicken, their pork, their beef, and their fish. And fish is sort of like one of four, if that. But once you only have seafood in your diet, you realize that the seafood counter is so diverse and that you can actually have a very full way of eating by never even getting near any land food meat.
Mm.
That said, I don't really recommend going on an all-fish diet because I did end up with high mercury levels. The kind of diet that I've been recommending is something I call the pescatarian diet, which is, you know, so I think people might be familiar with the Mediterranean diet. And all the Mediterranean diet is saying is let's limit our animal protein to a couple times a week. Let's have lots of fruits and vegetables, a lot of whole grains, nuts, and legumes. The pescatarian version would be more or less the same, except that when we're eating our animal protein, that we try to have a greater emphasis on seafood and sustainable seafoods like clams and mussels and oysters, like things like anchovies, herring, things that often end up in industrial purposes and not used as food. So that's what I've been trying to do. I should say there's a way to eat seafood. You don't only have to have mussels, clams, and oysters and anchovies. There's a tremendously great fish that we produce here in the United States called sockeye salmon, coming to us from Alaska. It's a really delicious fish. It comes to us frozen a lot of times, but because of the way that freezing technology has changed over the last 20 years, it's very high quality. Most fish that's coming to us from Alaska is flash frozen, so it's frozen before so quickly that ice crystals don't form and it doesn't burst those cell membranes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not mushy when you defrost it. So I'd say, you know, go for some sockeye salmon, have some mussels, have some anchovies, and you'll be, I think, thinner and healthier as a result.
Okay, Paul Greenberg, I know you're on a tight schedule. One last One last question, because this airs during the noon hour, people eating. So give us, put it out on the table in front of us, your favorite fish dish after you are the most credible source, if there is one, someone who's eaten only fish for a year.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have to go back to your sockeye salmon, which is very easy to cook if you get one of those portions skin on. Usually a lot of supermarkets have them in the freezer section. And I should say, you know, go right to the freezer section. Don't get the defrosted, already previously frozen fish. Get the frozen fish. Defrost that sockeye salmon. Pat it dry, salt and pepper. Put it under the broiler, skin side up, and in 5 minutes you'll have lunch.
Okay, and wild caught. You want wild caught fish, right?
Well, you know, so the sockeye salmon is wild. I'm not opposed to farmed fish, and you can. There's a good product called Blue Circle that produces salmon using increasingly ingredients that aren't coming from wild fish for their feed. So I pick up those portions oftentimes at Whole Foods. But again, if I have a preference, if I have a choice, I'll go for the Alaskan sockeye if I can.
Okay, Paul Greenberg, author of The Omega Principle, Seafood and the Quest for a Long Life and a Healthier Planet. So much in your fascinating book we didn't get to talk about, Paul, but thank you for spending time with us.
My pleasure, Ben, and good luck to everyone there, and hope you can all eat healthier and make a healthier environment.
I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Let's talk now about aquaculture here in Iowa with our two guests for the remainder of the hour. Mark Bratz is with us, CEO and co-founder of Iowa Shrimp Farms in Sigourney. He joins us from Colorado. Hi, Mark.
Good afternoon, Ben. Thanks for having me on your show.
Well, thank you for being with us. Joe Morris is with us as well, professor of natural resource ecology and management, also director of the North Central Regional Aqua Center at Iowa State University, one of five such centers in the U.S. Joe Morris, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Let's start with you, Mark. Many listeners, I would guess, would not know that we farm shrimp here in Iowa in some places. Tell us about your business.
Well, we started back in 2015. One of our employees had saw a piece on the TV about a gallop in northeast Iowa raising shrimp and wanted to know if we'd ever consider it. So we did some homework, and, you know, we knew it was going to be a risky piece. So the exciting part of it was overwhelming, so we got involved in it. I will tell you up front that we chose to stop operations last week.
Uh-oh. What happened?
Well, here's the deal. We learned that the supply of nursery PLs, the small little shrimp, I mean, they're the size of an eyelash or less, past October of this year was going to be just close to zero supply. So we, because of hurricanes, product being shipped overseas or whatever. So for us, we're doing a lot of research to improve our processes, and frankly, we're burning through capital to get this done, and with no PL supply post-October, we thought we'd better stop now, and because really, you got to keep doing this or you're going to lose what you've learned.
Mm-hmm.
So.
You mean, Mark, stopping for good?
Well, I would say that for us, we were ultimately undercapitalized. There's a significant R&D effort that's needed with this whole deal. And for us to keep going, I think in the future, we really would, to start the business back up, we would need to know that the PL supply was available to us and that we could have PLs going forward. And then we'd also need we would need additional investment capital from the outside, you know, a fourth partner or your involvement from universities such as Iowa State or something like that that wanted to take advantage of a pretty I think we got a really awesome system in our Sigourney warehouse.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're not ruling it out, but it's not going to happen in the near future.
Correct.
Okay, Joe Morris, from your vantage point at ISU at the Aquaculture Center there. Well, start off by telling us, what is the mission of your center?
We're funded by the USDA Department of Ag, and our focus is on the research and extension programming for the 12-state region and for the private industry itself. So our center's fairly unique amongst the five centers because the North Central region is such a diverse aquaculture industry compared to the southern states or the western states.
Mm-hmm. What do you make of Mark's story here? Here we had seemed like, except for the lack of what he needs, the little PLs from hatcheries, he would have been thriving, Joe.
Well, that is a main issue, especially when your food, your brood stock or your seed stock for your production does come from other states. And I think from my perspective, it's very frustrating for private industry to be going get this far down the road and then all of a sudden find out they can't get the source of their stock that goes into the population. And, you know, those are the type of things that sometimes beyond folks' control, especially like the PLs for the shrimp industry. Mother Nature has a habit of clamping down some sources, and unfortunately that's the case in this situation.
Mm-hmm. So, Mark, what would have been the answer to have those hatcheries up here further north? Can you have those hatcheries outside of the coasts?
Well, I think there are... There's one group in the state of Iowa that's working on that, and then we were approached as a potential place to have a hatchery that's been kind of in discussion. It didn't move along fast enough at this point for us to, you know, to take care of our commercial operation. But for it's my understanding it could be done. And for us in our Sigourney warehouse, you know, we own this warehouse. It's 100,000 square feet. It's on 14 acres. We walled off 2,500 square feet, which is the 2,000 square foot of that is where we have the ability to produce the shrimp. We have tanks in there, and these are cascade tanks are stacked up so we can better utilize the square footage in the building. But we're in an awesome location. You know, our production right now, Ben, is we're really, we got up to about 25% survival rate. And we were targeting 50% survival rate in our financial analysis. So we were making progress. We went from killing 100% of the shrimp to producing about 300 pounds of shrimp per month. And when we would start the harvest, we would have shrimp that were 25 to 28 count per pound. Towards the end of the harvest, you know, after a month of harvesting out of the tank, we would have shrimp that was 16 to 22 count per pound. So
those are nice size, right?
Oh. Yeah, we've had shrimp that were 30 to 42 gram shrimp. That's very big.
Mm-hmm. And you supplied to who is interested in this shrimp? I mean, they're getting shrimp that is as fresh as can be, right?
Yeah, I would say that we are really starting to get some traction on the marketing side. The local community was very good about buying shrimp from us. For example, one person bought 50 pounds for his son's graduation. Restaurants were buying shrimp from us. We're starting to get more and more interest there. We did some cookouts, like at some of these microbreweries that seemed to work out well. So we were getting that going. So it's kind of disappointing that the PL supply was going to stop, really. I mean, really going to be challenging post-October to get those shrimp. And you know what? We still have plenty of challenges. You know, we're at 25% survival rate. We are finding that the nitrate level in the water was our challenge. And that's an interesting conversation in the state of Iowa. You know, we have nitrate problems in our rivers and stuff. But we really have nitrate problems in the water that's, you know, a byproduct of the shrimp's waste and the feed that we're putting in there. It's tough to regulate the feed consumption because you got to remember the water. This is a saltwater system. And we're doing biofloc system, and this water looks like a latte. So you can't see the shrimp in there, and it's tough to measure how much feed they're consuming.
Wow, interesting.
Overfeeding is bad. So.
Mm-hmm. Joe Morris, let's talk about fish farming in Iowa. How large scale is that going on?
Well, I've been at Iowa State University for 30 years. I remember when I'm originally from Western Iowa myself, and I remember when I came back to being gone for 10 years. I was surprised to see there has been a number of aquaculture industry operations going on. In fact, we have some farms, our third and fourth generation fish farms. And so when I first came back here in 88, there was about 15 to 20 sustainable operations. And that has been fairly stable over the years. But in recent year, I think the last aquaculture census was in 2013, We had 30 aquaculture operations surveyed, but what's interesting for me, we had aquaculture conference last fall, and we had about 250 folks show up here at aquaculture. A lot of people are interested in the topic, and last time I checked was in 2017, there was over about 107 licensed permit holders for aquaculture operations.
Mm-hmm. So the tendency is toward more aquaculture in the state.
I think the tendency is there, but I think you're going to see some changing, and maybe the numbers are changing going up, but you'll see the diversity changing over time as people get into it, find out maybe that's not what they want, mm-hmm. or they get out because of things like beyond their control, which
right.
is unfortunate.
Happens to be on the weekend, I grilled some 5 fresh trout for my family, grilled them, but I bought them fresh. They looked fresh. It said farmed trout. Didn't say where they were from Costco. Where do you suppose those fish were raised? Do you think here in Iowa?
I would imagine probably came from out of Idaho. If you go to buy,
Idaho?
Most of when you go in, if you buy channel catfish.
No, this was trout.
And then go trout. Mm-hmm. Most of the trout are produced, I'd say 80, 85% probably produced in the state of Idaho itself.
Oh, okay. Why couldn't Iowa do what Idaho is doing?
No reason why. When I first came up here, there was a trout producer here in Ames. And,
all right.
And he had a sizable business. Mm-hmm. He's no longer business for things beyond operation. But there's no reason why we couldn't.
You can make more money with beans or corn or whatever?
Well, I mean, a lot of the struggle folks have is like things like trout or catfish, things like that. Some of the information can be transferred to the state of Iowa. Some things cannot be. Sometimes the price of operations, water costs, things like that could be prohibitive.
Mm-hmm. But there are regulations for fish farming just like there are for livestock,
oh,
right?
Oh, sure. There are regulations. If anyone interested in aquaculture, you have to have a permit from the Iowa DNR on an annual basis.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what do fish eat when they're farm-raised?
Most raised fish are, again, goes back to, I used to raise channel catfish myself in Texas.
Uh-huh.
And prepared diets, instead of preening a dog chow, preening a catfish chow, same type of things. And the same thing with the trout chow, things like this, or Mark might have had something on shrimp chow. So there are diets made specifically for that group of animals you're trying to produce.
Mm-hmm. When you look a little longer term, Joe, into aquaculture in Iowa, do you see it moving much, remaining stable, diversifying into other sorts of aquaculture?
I think it's going to be growing. I think it'll be diversified as they look into other alternative fish species besides trout, catfish. I mean, like what Mark is doing, shrimp production. It could be things like tilapia. We have a large tilapia operation going in the state of Iowa. So there's going to be a diversity of products, it's just like there's a diversity of consumers and different product for different consumers.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Mark Brantz, you're still with us of
yeah.
Iowa Shrimp Farms in Sigourney. What thoughts do you want to leave us with? It sounds like you had a product. You had a steep learning curve, no doubt. You only started in 2017 with your shrimp. What do you see in the future? Do you see more aquaculture, or if this doesn't pan out? For you, you go to what?
Well, I like shrimp. It'd be nice if that would materialize. You know, we're in a building that, when we bought this building 10 years ago, it was empty. It sat empty for 10 years, and we've got this thing totally refurbished. It's in Sigourney, Iowa. So I think raising fish or shrimp or whatever in these aquaculture in these buildings, now this is a large building, but I think around the country there's probably opportunities for that to bring some economy to this. This building, even at the 25% survival rate we have right now, if it was economically viable, would produce 250,000 pounds of shrimp per year in that building. So that's exciting, you know. And then the responses we're getting from our customers is that, you know, not only this is local, fresh, sustainable fish operation, you know, we have there's excellent feed conversion rates for the shrimp. When they, you know, they convert the feed to protein, it's like we're around 1.5 pounds of feed per pound of gain. So that's excellent compared to what other meat proteins are out there.
Mm-hmm. Livestock, land animals, you mean?
Correct. And then the product tastes good. A lot of people that have it compare it to lobster, and we were harvesting shrimp during the day before 3 o'clock, and people could have that on their dinner plate that night, as opposed to shrimp we're used to eating, which is probably coming from Southeast Asia, that's been in a container, you know, frozen for 6 to 8 months. So I think that's also why we get feedback that the shrimp is firmer, you know, it's more like lobster, so excellent.
Mm-hmm.
But I would share this for the future for us, you know, if the shrimp thing, which we've shut operations down, but we're not going to likely cannibalize our operation. We do have an excellent system. We've got natural gas generator backup. We've got separately metered gas and electric, so we know what resources go into the system. And we have so much capacity to grow, not only in the inside of the building, but on the outside on the 10 acres. So we'd like to find ways to maybe explore aquaponics. Are we going to raise trout, just like you were talking about a little bit ago? Or do we work with Joe at – I'd like to work with Joe at Iowa State University. By the
okay.
way, I went to Iowa State. And have an intern program where they could come down, some interns can come down and utilize our system to launch – we put up a greenhouse or use our 10 acres to do whatever.
Okay, Mark, we're running out of time, but those sound like great thoughts for the future. Joe Morris, tell us how people can find out more about your center, perhaps those interested in turning to aquaculture as a livelihood.
Sure. We do maintain an updated website, ncrac.org. In that website, I think, compared, you know, when I first came back here some years ago, there are resources out there, fact sheets, videos of that, and I ask a lot of questions, and feel free to give me my office a call at anyone's convenience.
Okay. Joe Morris, he's the director of the North Central Regional Aqua Center at Iowa State University. Mark Bretz, CEO and co-founder of Iowa Shrimp Farms in Sigourney. Mark and Joe, thanks for enlightening us about a few things we didn't know about aquaculture right here in Iowa. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Caitlin Harrop. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.